You're listening to the Rural Advancement Podcast. Rural Advancement provides resources to empower, equip, and encourage rural pastors and churches. Join our community by visiting us at ruraladvancement.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Rural Advancement. This is the podcast that is by rural leaders and for rural leaders. It is our goal every single week, week in and week out, to bring you content that is not just spoken to the rural church, but is spoken by people who get it. People who have lived, worked, and ministered in small, out-of-the-way places, and people who truly understand the immense value of the work that God does there. I am your host, Joe Epley, and this week, I had the opportunity recently to be interviewed on a podcast called Christianity Now that looks at kind of how Christianity plays out in different spheres of society. And the host of that is a gentleman named Josh Ziefel, who serves as the campus pastor at Northwest University of the Assemblies of God. And we just had an awesome conversation. And so one of the reasons I love kind of the chance to talk about rural in that setting is that on the Rural Advancement Podcast, there are plenty of moments where I get to kind of take in information and hear from all sorts of sources of wisdom. But when somebody asks me those questions, it's a fun opportunity for me to kind of synthesize, to draw my own conclusions, and to really put in very compact language some of the big picture lessons that keep emerging from the stories that we share every single week. And so for this week, we're just going to check out that interview. It's a bit of a longer interview, but I left it in one part. And I hope you enjoy my conversation about rural church and rural ministry that I had with Josh Ziefel.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Christianity Now, the podcast where it's not abnormal to talk about things that are rural. I don't know if that rhymes, but I'm trying. I'm always trying. Hi, everyone. My name is Joshua Ziefel, and I am your host, Dean of the College of Ministry here at Northwest University in Kirkland, Washington. And today, my guest is the Reverend Joe Epley, Student Ministries Director of the Montana Ministry Network of the Assemblies of God and host of the Rural Advancement Podcast. Hi, Joe.
Hello, Josh. How you doing, man?
Good. How are you doing today?
I'm doing good. I sympathize with your attempts to pronounce the word rural No one can ever agree how many syllables, what should be emphasized. I feel like different phases of rural say it differently. Like if you're in Arkansas, that rural is gonna hit different.
Yeah. I'm from the East Coast, so I try to get that rural, but it feels too much effort.
Yeah, that hard. It's tough.
Real quick before we go anywhere, and sorry for those of you who are listening and can't see, I noticed a rooster on the screen. Where did the rooster come from?
So I have this nickname that has just persisted since I was a teenager. I was on a missions trip. Mm-hmm. It was like an AIM trip, you know, ambassadors and missions trip to the Assemblies of God.
Okay, yeah.
I was a sophomore in high school, and we were taking a trip that had all these different youth groups in the state of Montana. And these two boys from a random other youth group thought I looked like Chicken Little from the animated movie. I think it was the glasses, the general nerdy demeanor. Yeah. Maybe I had some anxiety. I don't know what it was. But just like the spread of a virus or something, you had all these youth groups on this missions trip. Yeah. Camp was a month later. And so by the time church camp rolls around, I've officially been dubbed Chicken Joe. And then it was going to die at some point. Yeah. Like I became a pastor. I moved towns. Like I was still in the state. And then like it just right when it was about to die out, somebody would bring it up. And then eventually I just decided, I guess this is who I am. And so Chicken Joe got his pastor's license. Right. He became Reverend Rotisserie. And then when I became the DYD, people started calling me Director Drumstick. And it just like it will not stop. I get chicken themed items. I was presented with a live chicken at camp, which violates a lot of camp rules to just bring a live animal into the sanctuary. But it's definitely I use it mostly at this point for novelty, connection with students, kind of that flair of fun. But it is a weird fun fact. For sure. It's
works
a weird,
for me.
It's my spirit animal, I guess.
I wish I had a animal sidekick, but I do not. So it's unfortunate. So Joe, you've already said, I mean, you obviously the student ministries director there in Montana, and you're hosting a podcast discussing rural ministry and maybe other things rural as well. What else should we know about you?
I think it's funny you asked this question. I'm like, well, I could tell you about like my family. They're actually much cooler than I am. I've got this awesome wife. Mm-hmm. Her name's Beth. We've been married 10 years and she went to Evangel University.
Okay.
Graduated with public administration. She's an ordained pastor. She's on a preaching team. She's done economic development. She's working with nonprofits to help refugees. Like she's just hands down the coolest person I know.
Wow.
And so I love having her in my life. And then I got these two little girls. One of them is almost seven. Her name is Elodie. Mm-hmm. And she is just in her like goofy kid stage, which for those who don't have kids, it's just like when they discover facial expressions and like they know the structure of jokes, but not every joke is inherently funny.
Okay.
But because they're trying so hard, it's really hilarious. And then I've got this four-year-old, Eleanor, and she, in the words of my wife, and I, we share these a lot, just has big emotions, whether they're big positives, big negatives.
Yeah.
So they are just a bundle of joy. My oldest daughter, to add to my list of weird nicknames, about a year ago decided to start calling me T-Bone, as if I'm some stepdad from a biker gang or something. And I have no idea why, where, how. We've questioned her. We're like, where did this come from? And so now I'm having this whole identity crisis. Am I man, chicken, or steak? I don't really know. But they just bring a lot of joy to my life. I reside in Billings, Montana. I've spent my whole life in the state of Montana. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, I'm sure we'll get into my journey, but those are some random fun facts.
Yeah.
You know?
Okay. Well, sorry for this joke. You're a high protein kind of guy, I guess, with all those.
Saying, you know, that's what I'm saying.
All right. Well, opening question that I ask our guests. Kind of comes to us by means of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. So the question is this: who is Jesus Christ for us today? How would you answer that question?
Yeah, I'll admit that having listened to your podcast, I definitely have thought about this before. Mm-hmm. But the answer I keep landing on is the idea that in an information age, mm-hmm. right, and we could go through the stats on like how quickly information in our society is just doubling, like the sheer amount of content volume, the internet, like everything is produced, this kind of information wave on steroids. And at no point in history do I feel more heavily the words of, it really describes the Holy Spirit, but I think it you know, obviously the whole Godhead is involved mm-hmm. here, but the idea of a guide into all truth, mm-hmm. right? Like we need a navigator. We need somebody who can not just tell us what to believe, but to help us sort through all the options in our world and get that sense of what is God's will and how do we follow him. And so for me, Jesus, I think, represents now more than ever kind of this guide into all truth kind of energy.
Okay. All right. Thank you for that. The theme today for our episode is something that you are well familiar with, both in terms of your ministry work and also your podcast work. The theme is rural ministry. I will try to pronounce that correctly each time. So confession here, I think I thought I grew up in a rural area until I started listening to some episodes of your podcast and heard a little bit about your experience. I mean, people don't tend to think of New Jersey, where I'm from, as rural in any way.
Sure.
But in the southern part of the state, kind of where I grew up, it is amongst the more rural parts of New Jersey. You know, there's, you know, farmland, things like this, whatnot. I think I heard the local high school, one of them got school was canceled the first day of hunting season, things like that, which might be commonplace in other rural areas. But compared to some of the conversations, some of the things I've heard about you, and I want you to share in just a minute, very different setting. So why don't we start off thinking about this rural theme by telling us a little bit about your story. What is your connection to rural America and rural ministry? And how did you end up doing what you're doing and focused on this kind of ministry area?
Sure. I definitely feel like I came into the, you know, what we'll call, and I'm sure we'll get into definitions, but this experience of rural ministry mm-hmm. as an outsider, because, and if I say I'm from a big place, mm-hmm. a lot of people are going to really balk at me because I've lived in Montana my whole life. Yeah. And there are some states where you just by default say, hey, if you know, Kansas is after your city, like you're just in a rural place, like Wichita, Topeka, they're big places. But again, the whole state, the feeling, whatever.
Yeah.
And Montana very, very much is a rural place.
Mm-hmm.
However, I did grow up in Billings, which is, you know, about 100 to 120,000.
Mm-hmm.
And so for my experience, the idea of like ranches, farmlands, a distance to drive to amenities, this wasn't really present in my upbringing, in my life. And so to move from I accepted a youth pastor position to move from Billings, Montana to Baker, Montana, which is a small town that's like a stone's throw from the North Dakota border.
Mm-hmm.
So we are deep in eastern Montana. Yeah. We're on the border of oil field country.
Okay.
And it's pretty desolate. The town I was in was 1,200 people.
Yeah.
And so you're talking about 100 times smaller than where I was at.
Yeah.
And so I went from I could eat at a different restaurant every day for a year and still never repeat it, even in Billings, to like having six bars that all doubled as different restaurant varieties. And then everything closed at 8:30 and it was 80 miles to Walmart. And there was definitely maybe some local coffee shops, but depending on what sports were happening in the owner's son's life, you never knew if it was open or not. You know, it's just that kind of whole, it was a whole introduction. And so it was a really jarring experience. Yeah. I tell people that like after a couple months, and I moved there when I was like 21. So I go from like, I'm a night owl by nature. I love being out and about, driving around, doing whatever. And everything's closed. And I just like, after 8 o'clock, I'm like, I don't know what to do. And so one night it was like 10:30 at night. And I was just sitting in my house or at the youth center we operate, and was just like, I've had enough of this. And so I drove 80 miles one way to Miles City, Montana. It's actually
there you go.
The cowboy capital of Montana. but they had at least like a Wendy's or an Arby's or some form of fast food that was open late. And I rolled into the Wendy's drive-thru at midnight. And so the drive-through closes at midnight.
Oh, no Frosties for
and
you.
And so I drove 160 miles for gas station food, like 160 till 1:15 in the morning.
Yeah.
Just like, because it was such a jarring thing. And so you might say, well, that doesn't really set you up to like fall in love with a place like this. Enter my wife, who was the pastor's daughter. She was on my youth staff. We got to know each other. Yeah. Maybe it was love for the girl, but I really think the Lord uses anything in our lives to push us certain directions. Yeah. But she really challenged me. She said, hey, you have to love where you're at or not be here. I mean, it was she probably not said that strongly, but she really, she was passionate. She had grown up in small town, and she was the first one to really introduce me to this idea that like place matters and overlooked places have people that are made in the image of God. And I know that sounds so fundamentally obvious. But it took me relearning how to value something. And what happened was, kind of a side part of this story, is I end up as a youth pastor. You know, the Assemblies of God is our tribe, of course. Yeah. And so there was in eastern Montana. So we're talking about the eastern third of a very large state. There were probably 15 communities, all of them 5,000 or less or 7,000 or less people. All of them had an AG church, and I was the only paid or volunteer youth staff in 15 churches.
Wow.
And so I decided, man, I'm kind of lonely. I don't have a lot of peers. Like, what's going on? And so I just got in my car and I started driving, and I would drive an hour to one town, 3 hours to another town, 4 hours round trip to this. I mean, just all over the place. Yeah. And I would sit down in rundown bowling alleys where we're having the same chicken strip meal, or I'd sit down at their church, and you just begin to hear stories. And I remember, again, it's one of those processes you can't pinpoint, but by the end of it, you kind of have that aha moment. Yeah, and the Lord just says, Joe, do you realize how important these people are?
Yeah.
One of my personal heroes was a gal named Twyla Kunst. I say was, it's not like she's not around anymore, but she was the DYD of North Dakota. Mm-hmm. And her philosophy as a youth director was, we are going to find Davids in the field.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, we are going to go to the overlooked places and see who God is pulling out of there, seeing the value there, seeing how much the people in these places matter.
Yeah.
And so by the end of this whole process, I was in Baker for 10 years as the youth pastor and associate pastor, and then took this role as youth director. Yeah. But in that 10-year period, it went from like, God, I will tolerate this, to like, I guess I accept this, to man, this place is actually pretty all right, to finally, and of course, this is how the Lord works. I finally got to a point where I said, God, if I am here and I'm ministering to the same 100 people in this parish, in this congregation for the rest of my life, I will be content with that, because obedience to you matters. And then he said, well, why don't you move? And I said, well, okay, that seems very anticlimactic, but that's fine. But it was a lesson I had to learn. And so, and during that time, I got connected, to give credit where credit is due, I got connected with a gentleman named Dwight Sandoz, who actually runs an educational program, a master's in rural ministry through Trinity Bible College and Graduate School. And he reached out to me and said, hey, I love your story and I just want you to be a part of what I'm doing. That's he great. Started this organization called Rural Advancement. And the whole point was, why not make resources that are not just for rural people, but are by rural people, people who understand the context and what happens there. And so from that, we kind of developed this partnership, and somehow you wake up and you go, am I somehow like now becoming the spokesperson for a whole experience and a whole niche of the church? And it has been a fun journey. And even moving back to Billings, where our network office is, I still have carried that passion. And now as DYD, I'm driving to a bunch of rural communities talking with these pastors. And so I won't bore you with too much more length, but that is for sure the story there.
So the podcast that you do, Rural Advancement, connected to that organization, did you start that podcast? Was that already existing, or how did that come about?
So basically, again, I give a lot of credit to kind of Dwight and Nadine Sandoz, who run this. But when I came on the scene, they had really dabbled in the podcast. It had been around, and then during COVID, you know, it wasn't really consistent, and maybe there was a moment where it was put on pause. And so as I started helping him, I was writing articles and blogs and interviewing people, and I said, hey, I like podcasting. Can I take this over? I'll turn it into like a weekly thing. I'll host it for you. And he was gracious enough to say, absolutely. And so we ended up just starting it. And so I think I've done probably over 100 conversations by this point. And you're talking pastors from towns of 98 people, rural authors, practitioners, thinkers. Wow. I'm sure you've had the same experience on this podcast, but once or twice, because again, it's still a very niche crowd. Like nobody's knocking down the door for like a rural pastor focused podcast. Okay. But the couple times someone has reached out and said, hey, this really meant a lot to me. I love it. They're like, great job. And I feel kind of like I'm sure you do, where I'm like, I don't know that am I a good host, or am I just good at asking smart people questions? And like, that's how so whether anyone's listening to it, whether it's making this huge impact, I am learning a ton from just interviewing these incredible leaders who a lot of their stories are just not going to be told. And there's some, there's some quote unquote names and people on there who have had greater influence, but a lot of them, again, are names you're just never going to hear or recognize because they are busy doing God's will in small, out of the way places.
Yeah, I know. It's interesting to hear you mention that about just the podcast kind of enterprise, because I was thinking, I think maybe last night, I'm like, I just like talking to people and might as well record it.
And maybe one day I'll get paid for it. Like, I don't know. Wouldn't that be cool?
Oh, wouldn't that be great? You're much further down the road than I am on that. But
I don't think
it's just fun. For the sake of this podcast, probably yours as well, you get to talk to people that you find are interesting and you want to learn something. So it's fun to kind of put that around. Okay. Defining terms. This may seem like a funny question, but maybe it isn't. I mean, I think all of us have an image of rural and some different things come to mind, but what is rural? How do you define that? What does that look like? What as a category?
Sure. I think it's hard because so many people want to define it so many ways. Mm-hmm. And like quintessentially for most people, if we say rural, we are probably thinking of Midwest rural, right? We're thinking of rolling farmlands, isolated, maybe the pioneers settling the Wild West. Uh-huh, we're really thinking of these frontier type communities.
Clark Kent is brought up by, you know.
You're right. Yeah. It's very like Kansas is the flyover state of it. Like it's very much that energy. Mm-hmm. However, rural is defined in a million ways. I mean, again, we've had people on here from New York to Florida to Texas to all over the Midwest to California rural to Northwest, Pacific Northwest rural. I mean, it's all different.
And Alaska rural is a whole different other thing.
Oh, and Alaska rural. And then you talk to the government and you're like, well, what does the government define rural as, or what does economics define rural as? And really, by the end of all these things, I'll use a couple different metrics. Number one, a lot of people agree on the phrase, rural would be like 10,000 or less in population. Okay. Now, that is not a hard and fast rule. I'd say there's tons of places that are 30,000, 40,000, 50,000 who behave like a rural organism in a sense. Mm-hmm. So there's kind of a limited definition there.
Yeah.
A lot of people will define it by access to amenities. So again, if you're far from Starbucks and Walmart and kind of these amenities of life, if you are traveling any length to get groceries and do these things, you know, a lot of people might define it by that. A lot of rural comes from subsistence on the land in a sense. Mm-hmm. So like a lot of extraction industries, agriculture, ranching, oil, timber, a lot of the things that live off the land, if you will. But the best definition I have found over this podcast is that rural is frankly, it's a mindset, and it's frequently marked by like a highly relational outlook. It's a shared understanding of what it's like to maybe live in a small place. It's a, again, it's a network of relationships that you kind of all agree to uphold in a sense. And it becomes a way of just kind of viewing the world. It's a lens that's historically has been defined by uncertainty and scarcity. It's a place where change has to go through a much different process than it might in a city or metropolitan area. It's a place where ministry looks different. The power of presence comes comes up a lot in rural, and obviously we'll get into that. But yeah. But I think the best way to define it is like it is a way in which people see the world that kind of revolves around these things: relationships, presence, kind of these shared community goals, kind of the uncertainty of the future because a lot of rural America has experienced decline and different seasons. Yeah. And so there's a set of shared experiences that tends to be across the board.
Yeah. You know, I don't have the data in front of me. You may know this, like there's a history is my discipline, but there's a statistic or a date somewhere, like it is relatively recent, I think, that the majority of Americans were born in a more rural or farming setting. Like something like before 1950 or before 1960, the majority of Americans were born in that kind of setting. And it's only more recently maybe changed away from that. So,
right. And you've seen the trends for sure. Like I would say that there have been alternating cycles where everyone's in kind of rural America. They all flock to the cities. Yeah, the city's conditions become something people don't want. And they kind of long for this idyllic sense of being removed from that hustle and bustle.
Yeah.
Another definition of rural is like a different pace of life. There's just a different pace to how you live your life. And so, yeah, I would say some of those factors come into play. And right now, culturally, we're kind of seeing a rural renaissance, if you will, because they're, especially since COVID and a lot of jobs going remote, people are saying, man, if I don't have to do the hustle and bustle where I'm at, and I could go live in a small town where my kid can ride their bike and not feel as scared of what's going to happen. Like there's a safety there and an invitation there and kind of a, again, an idyllic charm to that pace of life.
Yeah. So rural ministry.
Sure.
Again, I know that one definition of rural ministry is ministry in a rural context, but maybe if you could, if you're able to explore that definition a little more, and then not only what is rural ministry, but how would you define it as different than ministry in general? Like how would you think about those things?
Yeah. I think I used to define these terms a lot sharper, but as we know, like you never want to become your own echo chamber. And I've really tried hard in diving into rural, not to do it at the expense of other facets of the body of Christ.
Yeah.
But what I will say is all of ministry is going to involve loving people well, you know, pastoring well, forming good communities in your church. But I would say in rural ministry, there's some things that are just much more prevalent.
Yeah.
As markers of success or as markers of what ministry looks like than it is in other places. So, for example, rural is much more tied to physical place than other ministry contexts.
Okay.
So I would tell people like a rural church has to care a lot about the town it finds itself in.
Okay.
I would contrast this with maybe like it, like for example, if I say, let's say we were both born in Chicago, you and me, right? If we were both born in Chicago, I might describe landmarks, restaurants I visited, schools I went to, and you might not share any of that because Chicago's huge. And like you might have grown up in a totally different suburb, totally different side of town. Whereas like rural, there is one shared town history.
Yeah.
There is typically in some of our smaller places, there's one, maybe two high schools. Everyone kind of had the same teachers, the same driver's ed instructor, are visiting the same 6 to 20 restaurant. You know, like it's all much more shared. And if you say, oh, the lake on the edge of town, a lot of times no one's questioning where that is. There's just a much more shared. And so a pastor or a leader in that context kind of has to take into account that the town matters, the place matters. And in people's thinking, you can't just value the church. You have to value the place. Another factor that's really huge is the ministry of presence looks different. In a larger congregation, almost nobody, except maybe the most stalwart of diehards congregants, believes that the pastor should be the one visiting every person in the hospital or conducting every funeral or every major occasion. But in a small town, it is viewed as your job. Like this is not just a church's job. This is your job.
Yeah.
You're the pastor. I'm the farmer. Farming is my job.
You know?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so you kind of get this mentality that says, like, if you're not, hey, I sent a deacon or hey, I sent whatever. And we can argue all day about whether that's right or wrong or what we should do leadership wise. But the perception is you are my pastor. You should be the one predominantly preaching. You should be the one visiting me when I'm sick. You should be there to christen my kids and do all those things. You know, you should be at all these major events. Going beyond that, so you've got this power of presence. And then in rural settings, you will also just by default, if you're doing it well, you will end up pastoring the community, and the line between what is the four walls and not four walls will become very blurry. Because again, in a large place, you might find it much harder to have intimate connections with people who are outside of your church or your normal, again, like you might go to a grocery store out of 100 in the large metropolitan area or like whatever. Whereas in town, you might be much more familiar with the coaches, the teachers, the police force, whoever, and they might just come to you, never having set foot in your church, and say, "Hey, I know you. Can you marry me and my partner? Mm-hmm. Can you provide some counseling here? Can you officiate this funeral? Can you be present to bless the opening of the rodeo?" You know, it's just like like you just might be the town pastor, and that can be just notably different. Where like you are going to kind of affect things on a different level. And so those would be some of the key ways, I think, where these elements are more present in a rural setting.
Yeah, I can, again, different but similar, thinking about where I grew up in a small church in southern New Jersey versus the large suburban church I go to now, maybe I can even feel some of those differences that you're pointing out. Certainly, at our large suburban church right now, I'm a transplant to Washington, so I don't know what they're doing with the local community. They do a trunk or treat. Right. I don't know. It's not, you know, and so it's a whole different kind of thing as opposed to, yeah, I can see that. Okay, so it's time for the good and the bad, right? So what are some of your favorite things about rural ministry? And then right after that, I'm going to say, what are the greatest challenges? So let's start with the good. What do you love about rural ministry?
I think a lot about like potential impact. Mm-hmm. And again, when you talk about rural ministry, the thing that people often overlook is you're right. You could have the entire town kind of at your back at some time saying, mm-hmm. "Hey, do we know about this guy? Do we like this person?"
Yeah,
whatever.
Yeah.
But on the flip side of that, if you're doing life as well as you can, if you're doing ministry, community, you're trying to connect with people, you really can change the entire demographic of a town.
Yeah.
Like you are having maximum impact.
Mm-hmm.
You can be one big fish in one really small pond, but again, everybody feels the effect of like your ministry in your life.
Yeah.
Currently in Montana, I know of a youth pastor who is also the mayor of their town. I'm not even kidding.
I love it.
He teaches at an elementary school as like his paid job, and then he volunteers as a youth pastor at his church, and then he also has been on the city council for a long time, but then like is the mayor of this small town.
That's
and
great.
So like you just like and now he's got the platform to change mm-hmm. the full reality of like the people he serves alongside. And so one of my favorite things about it is ministry impact. A second thing that I'm also going to describe probably as the greatest challenge, but I think is a positive, mm-hmm. is rural ministry will keep you honest. And I mean that as like a I feel like as pastors, we don't always like the fact that we're held accountable to a higher standard, but it for sure is important.
Yeah.
And one of the things about rural ministry that it has taught me is like holistic spirituality has to be like the way you live your life.
Mm-hmm.
And what I mean by that is like in a larger place, the odds of me coming across somebody I know in every place that I go is a lot rarer.
Yeah.
But in a rural setting, if I flip out on the checker at the local grocery store, it will directly impact people's trust in whether or not I should share the gospel with them.
Mm-hmm.
And so and people call it the fishbowl effect, and I know that it can be kind of stifling, but I also found it like a challenge to be risen up to where it's like, do I believe that God affects my whole person all the time? Because if he does, it's got to keep me honest. Like I can't just decide to be the angry parent at the Little League game because odds are one of my deacons is the umpire.
Yeah.
And one of the other pastors might be the, you know, coach and the other kid. Like it's just everything's so relationally close that again, you're kind of running into this thing.
It sounds like a small town helps you be discipled better too by holding
exactly.
a mirror to
and
your face, right?
I would say the process of discipleship has been a big win because again, you are kind of getting maximum FaceTime, maximum connection where your potential to easily walk by or walk with rather people is really huge.
Mm-hmm.
And then final note on that, I also think, if you're a ministry-minded individual, one of the questions we always ask ourselves is, how do I reproduce another ministry-minded individual? Mm-hmm. And the thing I love about small-town churches is excellence does not always tend to be as much of a worry as opportunity. And
okay.
so In a large church, by default, your main stage, your Sunday morning service, if you will, is going to have a baseline level of preaching for to meet the expectations of your group. In a small town, people are going to still come to your church if you let the teenager get on stage and stumble through a sermon much quicker than they are in a larger setting. And so you have this kind of, honestly, and statistics would bear this out, is that a lot of pastors, spiritual leaders, missionaries, they're coming out of rural settings because the opportunity to hone ministry calling, and often the necessity, it's like, it's almost like, I wouldn't have taught you stuff, but we had nobody else. And so now we have to teach you stuff, you know? And so it's like, well, I hope you figured out, kid, because we gotta go. So those would be some of the positives for sure.
Let me ask you this. I'm curious. So you are from, well, you're from obviously a bigger community, but still, as you said, it's Montana. So it's limited,
Montana, a limited
ceiling. How important is it being to be from a rural background to thrive in that kind of ministry? Like, so for instance, me, Jersey, not nearly as rural anywhere, probably as you. Now I live in suburban Seattle. If I was plopped down into rural Montana, say, for instance, a town of 2,000, like, am I able to thrive there or is it just not going to work? Like, how does that fit together?
The honest answer is, and it's going to sound really cop-out-ish, but I think you thrive if you choose to thrive. And I think it boils back to a theology of obedience. It's like, am I going where God called me to go? Then I better become the person God's called me to be. And honestly, if I go back through these roughly 100 interviews I've been able to do on this podcast, I would say it's 50-50. I've met a ton of people who came from outside of a small town who like fell in love with, they were willing to put up with the extra scrutiny. They were willing to learn a different pace of living and they found fulfillment there. And I've met some people who ran from that context as fast as they could because they just couldn't thrive. And so obviously, number one, we're going to go back to obedience. But number two, I think the myth that you have to be of a certain whatever is just, it's almost damaging because I think it starts to make a list of, well, here's the places God could call me and here's the places God couldn't call me.
That's true.
And I think that whether we, whatever that label is, like, do you need to be an extrovert to thrive in a small town or an introvert? Do you need to be from a small place or a big place? The more qualifiers we put on places, the more we kind of, and that, this sounds really stern, I really don't mean it to be, but the more we kind of reject the universal message of the gospel. And the more we kind of say, okay, God, my obedience is here, but it's qualified. Now, is it challenging? Absolutely. Do I think that you have to take some genuinely intentional steps to like fall in love with an environment you're not used to? Absolutely. Does it help to marry someone from the small town? And then that way you have an incentive to stay there? Absolutely.
Like,
if you're already married, I don't know what to tell you. But it is true that like, I just think you can do it, but it takes such a deep commitment to obedience, to learning, to taking that posture of what if I was willing to go through the process? Because again, there's usually a high bar, but again, that, that acceptance, that fulfillment, that impact really is on the other side of that high bar.
Switching gears a little here, one of the things that I think would be interesting to talk about a little bit is the misconceptions or misperceptions from the outside that people have about rural areas or about rural ministry. Like what, I'm sure you've heard a lot of things or you've experienced a lot of things, biases, misconceptions, wrong ideas. Like what are there out there? Like what myths do you wish to dispel, Joe? Talk to me.
Number one, and this feels, this is probably the most soapboxy question you've asked me, okay, for the record. I mean, this is it. Like, this is where I get passionate. Number one, these places have merit on their own that has nothing to do with you. Like it is so common. If you talk to rural parishioners, deacon boards, churches, they will tell you a story of pastors who came for a year or two to get an inroad into the state that they wanted to work in or as a gateway, and then they will move on. Like rural as a stepping stone is often how it's treated. But ultimately, we have to dispel the myth that these places are only useful as long as they're useful to me. They're people made in the image of God. Like they are living and dying and dealing with their issues. I had in 10 years in rural ministry, there were 7 student deaths in a student population of like 200. Okay. Like, and it was cancer, suicide, car wreck. I mean, it was everything. And you're going to say, sorry, those people don't matter enough for me to stick around and pastor. Like it just, and that's not what people mean to say. And I'm saying, follow the call of the Lord.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But there are too many statistical stories of people saying this place only matters as long as it's useful to the next thing.
It's starter ministry. Reality, it's not, it's
yeah,
not
it's
real
starter ministry. Yeah. Or it's, I couldn't get a lead pastor in a big place, so I guess I'll serve my time. And it's like, mm-hmm. Hey, these people have worth beyond you. Again, soapboxy a little bit, but like, if you're going to tell me that no name people from backwater places cannot do good things for God, then we have to rule Jesus out. We have to just cancel him. We have to say, sorry, that guy's actually
not worth it. What good can come from there?
What good can come from Galilee, from Nazareth, right? It's just, it's ridiculous. So,
yeah.
So that's a misconception. Number two, I would say most people don't realize that, well, maybe I'll put it this way. A lot of people come into rural settings and they say, these people are stubborn. They don't want to change. And I'm sick of it. They're just backwards. They don't want to grow. And this is probably one of the number one reasons pastors leave. And what people don't realize about a rural place is it's not that they don't want to change. It's just that they're going to make you earn that change. Mm-hmm. They are not interested in change for its own sake.
Yeah.
Because their way of life has depended on being as consistent as possible. Mm-hmm. Okay, just to set the tone at whatever tone it is and say, we're going to stick with this because it's worked. And truthfully, the other thing we have to realize is these are people tied to the soil. Mm-hmm. I do not have statistics on this, but anecdotally, I would say that in a small church, I had a guy in my small church, and his parents helped plant the church, and he has been in the same church for all 82 years of his life. He has not left. And you're going to tell me that the 15 different pastors he's seen over that 82 years have more sway? Because guess what? He's seen it. He's seen you come in, share your big idea that you learned at a conference, half-heartedly apply it, not really take the time to know the church, the community, the people. And then when they don't put out or become the kind of congregation you want them to be in a year's time, you say, what stubborn, backwards people.
Yeah.
And the thing rural churches are asking is not, we don't want to change. They're saying, do you value and understand us?
Yeah.
Because I value this church a lot. Mm-hmm. I've been here 80 years. And if I'm going to let you change something that is precious to me, I need to know that you're not doing it recklessly, mm-hmm. or not doing it to get ahead, or not doing it to make a name for yourself. And so I would say, second soapbox, probably misconception, is that rural is this backwards place.
Yeah.
And then third, I would probably, as a good capstone comment, mm-hmm. I would say that rural is a place where most people perceive that they, man, just like naturally have a chip on their shoulder. Or I guess what I'm trying to say is like people say rural, like don't trust outsiders, right? They'll say like rural places aren't welcoming to me. And again, it kind of goes back to a history of abandonment. They've watched major industries leave their main streets. They've watched, we had a bank that we used in our town of Baker close. It was a Wells Fargo. And when we asked them about it, they said, yeah, there's not enough foot traffic in your area for us to justify this bank existing. And you're just basically saying you don't matter enough to have services. And like, that is the story. And so people come into rural places saying like, you know, like these people, you know, are missing the mark, or they don't want to welcome me in. And it's like, you have to be willing to just sit and learn. And it takes a while. I had somebody 9 years into my journey. Now, most people opened up before this, to be clear. There mm-hmm. were milestones and moments I hit where people trusted me. Mm-hmm. But this one couple sat down with me and said, you know, we've been watching you for a while now, and we just really think you're doing great stuff. Here's a donation to your youth center. I had been there almost a decade.
Yeah.
And these people are like, we've been eyeballing you. We think you're all right.
You're doing good, kid.
They've watched people come and go. And I think what we perceive as this, I don't want you around attitude, is really almost a self-advocacy. It's saying, hey, our place matters. Mm-hmm. And until we know that you believe that, it's harder for us to open up to you.
Because we've been burned before.
And that shouldn't always be condemned. It is worth expressing frustration. I was frustrated by it. It's okay to vent about it. But to just write it off and say, oh, these people don't ever want outside help. It's like, no, but they've just watched it fall flat again and again and again. So those are some misconceptions, I would say.
All right. So a little bit, again, thinking back maybe about my own context, is the two places that I've been involved in ministry and ministry adjacent work. I served in youth ministry in New Jersey, which is a relatively densely populated state. And I was in central New Jersey, Princeton, by that point. And I was involved with our youth department a little bit and things like that. And then I came out here at Northwest University, which is located in suburban Seattle. So you have, as you would imagine, around a major metropolitan area, some of the major large churches, large population centers and whatnot. And so what is commonplace, and you know this, in our church world, particularly maybe in those kinds of contexts, are pastors trying to figure out how to measure their effectiveness. And one of the easiest and most quantifiable ways to do that is numbers, attendance, growth, all of these kinds of things, because in some sense, the ceiling is unlimited. There are millions of people in the area who can come to your church, hundreds of thousands. Whereas in Baker, for instance, there are 1,200, probably a little more on the outskirts or whatnot, but there probably is, I don't know, when it comes to numbers and growth, it's not unlimited. It's very limited and bounded. So when people think about ministry success in a rural context, so much of the conversation is about numbers and growth and whatnot. But I also know that in a rural context, that looks probably a lot different. So how do churches measure success in those contexts when it may not be about so much about numbers as it is in other places? Like how would you understand that?
Yeah. First, I want to just point to experts in this conversation. There's a gentleman who grew up pastoring a church, or grew in ministry pastoring a church in the shadow of Saddleback Church with Rick Warren.
Yeah.
And his name's Carl Vaders, and he wrote a book called Desizing the Church. And we're actually going to have him on the Rural Advancement Podcast in about a month's time. But I read his book this spring, and he basically makes the premise. He takes us through the history of the church growth movement that originated kind of, you know, 60s, 70s, 80s, kind of into this mega church movement.
And really, again,
exemplified by like kind of Rick Warren and Saddleback, and how do we grow big but grow small, and how do you have your big, hairy, audacious goal, or whatever you call those. So, you know, all these terms and buzzwords we put to the church growth movement. But his book, Desizing the Church, first of all, to put it kind of bluntly, and you have to read the book to get the wording, but he kind of blows up the whole system. He says, hey, why did we ever turn to numbers to justify what we're doing? You know, and so in a rural setting, it is so tempting, because what happens is you can't claim numbers just from sheer numerical standing. So you can't say I've got the biggest church in the state, because again, when I tell you it is impossible to grow my church to 5,000 people when my entire county is 2,500 people, I'm not saying it like I don't have faith. I'm just saying it as a matter of genuine fact.
Statistically, like, it will not work.
unless something happens and people start multiplying like loaves and fishes, this ain't going to happen.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Like, it's just not going to work. But what we find in rural, and I've used this and still use this, I would start using percentages, right? And I think this is, I think if you read this book, you'll start to really dive into the theology on it. Uh-huh. But I would say, statistically, it is still okay for a rural pastor to say, what percentage of people am I affecting? Mm-hmm. Because you might have a church of 100 in a town of 1,000, and you're reaching 10% of your community. That's huge.
Yeah.
That matters a lot. In my youth ministry, we, after about 8-9 years, we tallied up from yearbooks and students and talking to people. We said, okay, about 75% of any given year of the student body, we would see come to our youth center.
Wow.
And then from about that, half of them would stick around for our youth programming. Mm-hmm. And you start to realize, like, man, we've had a pretty significant impact.
Yeah.
And so I do think that church ministers should look at impact. Mm-hmm. I think, like, overall impact.
Yeah.
But kind of getting away from the numbers game entirely, and this is going to sound so basic, but like, are people getting discipled?
Yeah.
One of the things that I think rural churches have the strength of, and I've already mentioned some of it, is like, in a larger church, people who would have been overlooked probably would never have gotten on stage to preach or lead worship or learn sound and tech or be called to be missionaries. And the rural church has the means and the opportunities to invest in people like that and to take people on the whole journey.
Yeah.
I would say their ceiling for how they cultivate people is extraordinarily high. Because rural church doesn't really value the formulaic approach to church anyways, most often, I think that you have maximum opportunity to say, we are going to walk alongside a life. I was talking to a church in a town of 600, literally like 2 days ago. And the pastor said, yeah, we have one young adult. He's 28. He wants to go into ministry. And our church of 20 people has now built up a scholarship fund that his entire Bible college will be paid for from just their 20-member church. And like, again, that kind of one-on-one investment is discipleship. And so we have to learn to say, are we affecting people? Eugene Peterson, obviously the late great, I mean, wrote a ton on like the nature of pastoral ministry
Montana
in his memoir.
Native, right? He's from Kalispell.
Montana native, he is. Yeah. He's from the Kalispell area. But he wrote in his memoir, The Pastor, he talked about how pastoring really is living and dying with people. And rural is that. I mean, if you stay in a community for 20 years, you might bury the grandparents, you know, counsel the kids of those people, then both dedicate, baptize, maybe send off to college, and then maybe marry the kids of those people, and then dedicate the grandkids of those people. And like, you need to measure, like, are we baptizing people? Are people getting saved? Yeah. Are we having an effect on our community? To finish this section, I think, and I think it's touched on in this book, Desizing the Church. I just can't recommend it enough. But what I would say is, in the Gospels, we see this pattern of Jesus. Jesus does good to all. Mm-hmm. He shows up places and just does good things. He heals people. He feeds. Yeah. He just does all this good. And what frustrates, probably if we take a full church growth model, mm-hmm. what's so frustrating about those stories is Jesus does not leverage those good deeds properly enough to grow his church. Like,
come on, Jesus,
he just doesn't
leverage
do that.
This a little more.
But what you see is Jesus kind of makes this case for, hey, what does a disciple do? They do good to everybody in front of them. God draws people, and whoever shows up, we disciple. And I think in the church growth movement a little bit, we've kind of put this emphasis on, well, we can make every formula happen to draw people. Mm-hmm. But that was, in my opinion, that's not necessarily our job. Mm. Our job is to do good to everybody, which everybody can do. Mm-hmm. Man, small towns, people are begging you to open a food pantry, take over a ministry, run the little league team, give out blessing baskets at Thanksgiving, help with economic development, bring a business to town, start a coffee. I mean, literally endless. Okay. Yeah. And if you as a rural church do good to everybody, God will draw people and you'll get to disciple the few that show up. And that is Jesus. That's what he did. Yeah. And so for me, when we talk about impact, you're right. I don't think we can measure it by the numbers, but I think we can say, am I on mission with what the Bible's saying?
Yeah.
And am I having impact? Am I doing good and seeing lives changed? Even if we sent out one missionary or baptized one person, is that not the will of the kingdom? Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah. Well, we're coming near an end here. Maybe a last question, then it's some closing thoughts. But my last question would be, and you've already just begun to touch on this, but one of the benefits, I think, to a role like yours is, and for those of you who don't know, the Assemblies of God is a national fellowship. And so there are district and student ministry directors all over the country in different districts, some from very urban states, some from more rural states. And you do get to do some traveling. You're in other places sometimes. You talk to other student leaders, other pastors, and things like this. So what do you think the rest of the church can learn about ministry from the lessons you've learned or others have learned in rural ministry? Like what can we who are not in that context learn from those experiences?
No, that's a really great question. I would say, again, a lot of this will probably summarize what we've talked about, but number one, I don't think excellence should ever be valued over developing people.
Okay.
I think that in church, we've used excellence as a standard. We need to have excellence in the pulpit, excellence on the stage, excellence in worship, excellence in administration. Yeah. And that's fine. But a lot of the people that you're recruiting to do excellently in your church got honed and grew their talents in a rural church.
Yeah.
And I say that a little tongue in cheek. I'm not sure every story lines up with that. But like, once again, sometimes out of necessity or out of just sheer culture, the rural church has worked so hard to say, we will take the nobodies, the overlooked, and say, we will breathe life into you. And we will make, we will give you opportunity. One of my favorite stories, and I feel comfortable sharing it because he shared it on the Rural Advancement podcast, is a mutual friend of ours, Kevin Gear.
Oh, yeah.
And Kevin Gear is a pastor of a church of thousands of people with six campuses across Montana. Mm-hmm. He is just crushing it when it comes to church growth. Again, if we used the metrics of numbers what, you know, you would say, man, that guy's baptized 300 people last year and the church has grown to thousands and whatever. Mm-hmm. He grew up in Glendive, Montana, a town of 5,000 people on the edge of the North Dakota border, 70 miles north of where I pastored. Okay. And he took over kids ministry at the age of 12.
Wow.
And he spent 5 years being, I'm going to use air quotes, and I don't care if he confronts me on it, but quote unquote, doing kids ministry as a kid for 5 years.
Yeah.
Who lets a 12-year-old just run this ministry? Well, what happened? They had an opportunity. They said, we don't care if it's polished. We're just going to give it to whoever's willing. And you're telling me that guy is now leading a church that we would label as classically successful.
Yeah.
And you look at that and go, isn't we should value developing people over excellence every time. And I get standards still have to be met. Expectations have to be met. But if you can't find it in a large organization, you have to create opportunities for people to preach, to grow, to apply skills, to not always have to worry about whether they're already done growing. Because truthfully, again, that's kind of a myth anyways. The second thing I would say is one of the things that I think matters in ministry, all facets of ministry, is relationship. And one of the things small towns taught me is that you cannot overlook people, no matter how annoying they are. And I, like, I'll give you an example. In a church of even, let's say, 150, 250, 300, you know, even as you start to approach what we would say a low or mid-sized church, if one grandma is mad at me, it will not affect my job. But if I'm in a church of 50, 40 people, that church grandma who's been around 60 years could mean the difference between me getting funded or even having a job. Okay. Like, and some people balk at that as a little bit they should. I mean, it is annoying when you're like, oh, all these people have a say in my job. When did that happen? However, I'm in a role now as a youth director where I am having to meet with and conversate with and talk to people ranging from 80s and 90s all the way down to teenagers and kids. And the small town church has a mandate, and again, due to the necessity of their context, is really good at least listening and learning to listen and finding common ground intergenerationally. Again, in a youth ministry, let's say in a town where there is a Bible college, you might say, oh, look at my cool youth staff with 20 young adults between the ages of 18 and 24. In a small town, my youth staff, man, if you talk just about the full-timers, we were lucky enough to have a couple people in their 20s, but also we had people in their 40s. We had dedicated grandparents making dinner who were in their 60s and 70s. It was less clean. And the thing is, I was forced to reconcile with all of them. Sometimes I feel like we have a lot of pastors and leaders, and this is probably a punchy statement, but it's worth reflecting, is I think we've got pastors who are walking around with half the set of skills they could have because their context has allowed them to ignore voices that are otherwise difficult to hear.
And I
believe that. I just think that, like, in a large church setting, you're not always nearly as bound by just the personalities and the more difficult people, because the church as an organization can move beyond the individual dissenting voices. But in a small town, so I guess my encouragement is, sit down with people whose perspectives you don't usually check.
That's my
lesson from small town, is like, I think we're really good at least taking into account greater perspective and saying, you know, like, I will take that 70-year-old's advice because I don't think they woke up this morning and suddenly hated the next generation. I think they do care about the gospel going forward amongst teenagers, and they might not express it the same, but I need to learn to listen to those people and those voices.
Well, that sounds, I mean, it sounds like a fundamentally pastoral task that you're engaged with there, you know? And, but yeah, it can be in the hustle and bustle of different scales of church, it can be easy to kind of pass this by, I suppose.
Well, and again, as we close, just to walk that back a little bit, I'm going to speak passionately, but I don't want people to walk away thinking there's this hard edge. It's just that in rural, you're maybe talking, instead of a 50-50, this might be like a 70-30. Like, it just shows up more often. It doesn't mean to say that in large churches, nobody's listening to other generations. Like, there are people doing it right all over the board. But again, these are some of the lessons that became some of the greatest foundations for my own ministry. And I hope that they're appreciated other places as well.
And the question was, what can we learn from the rural church? So receive, definitely. Well, I know I told you our time would be up right around now, so I will I'll bring things to a close. Joe, thanks so much for the conversation today. Obviously, the Rural Advancement Podcast, but where else, if people want to say, I like that guy, where can I find him on the internet? Where else can we find you on the internet or people contact you?
For sure. When it comes to me personally, I don't have a great internet presence. I'm not super into social media. Mm-hmm. I have a Facebook, Joseph Epley, that's okay. Me. And I have a Be Real, which, again, is very much a different kind of social media.
There's
so I really don't have Instagram. Yeah, like I have the oldest and one of the newest, yeah. And I don't have Snapchat and I don't have Instagram. And okay. I struggle with social media. Yeah, but for the Rural Advancement Podcast, there's a website, ruraladvancement.com.
Great.
And then on Spotify, if you search Rural Advancement, or on Apple Podcasts, mm-hmm. you can search Rural Advancement. Those are the two main platforms. Great. The podcast can be found on. And again, that is where you can have access. I would challenge anybody to not grow from these kind of things. We have all sorts of fun conversations that I think would apply to all of Christendom. But again, specifically, if you find yourself in a small context, it has helped me just become a fundamentally better minister through these conversations. And so we'd love for you to check it out. We'd love for you to recommend people. We'd love for you to say, hey, I think there's somebody you should talk to. Mm-hmm. Because again, true to rural form, you're just not going to find those voices unless people know where they are.
Well, folks, if you'd like this conversation, definitely go over to Rural Advancement and check out the podcast there, because there is just lots more where that came from Joe and from the conversation partners he has. So thank you very much for your time today. I hope that the fast food places are open tonight when you go to them. And it's been fun. Thanks, Joe.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you again for tuning into this interview with Josh Ziefel from the Christianity Now podcast. There will be a link to that podcast in the show notes. Obviously, it diverts from only talking about rural and definitely touches on other issues and things in society as it relates to Christianity. But as usual, I just want to encourage you, hopefully, even as you listen to this episode and some of the summary of my thoughts on rural, you left encouraged and empowered, knowing that God sees you in what you do in small, out-of-the-way places. As always, you can find us in a lot of formal ways by going to ruraladvancement.com or checking out Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And please feel free to leave us a rating or review. These are really important to help the podcast kind of get out there. But true to rural form, the best way to spread this podcast is to find another rural pastor or leader and say, hey, there's a set of conversations that I think you should be a part of. But for this week, I have been your host, Joe Epley. And this has been an interview with Joshua Ziefel from the Christianity Now podcast. And for now, we will see you next week.